What's up, everybody, and welcome to the Junction City Justice Podcast. Today we have a story for you that spans four decades of Ogden history, 1956 to 1986. It's the story of a hardworking beat cop, James, or Jim, Clemens, also known to his co-workers as Clem. And really, this isn't so much of an interview, I mean, while it is that, an interview of Jim's life. This is an interview that takes us as close as we will ever come to stepping into a time machine to know what the streets of Ogden were like during those times directly from the source, which is something that we don't have a lot of opportunities to do. Jim's going to tell us some stories. Some we'll like and some we won't. But I can guarantee you, this is a little slice of Ogden history that we are trying to preserve for all time. And it's part of Jim's story. And that's also something we're looking to preserve for the Clemens family. So the stage is set. The stories are in place. All we have to do is reach back through time in our little time machine, that is Jim Clemens, and shake hands with history and with the streets of Ogden at the time. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jim Clemens. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Junction City Justice Podcast. We are sitting here with James Clemens. Is there anything you prefer to go by?
Jim.
Jim. Perfect. And Jim, you were a police officer in Ogden from when?
1956 to 1986.
So we are going to talk with Jim about really four decades encompassing of Ogden City history. Jim, where are you from originally?
Boston.
I see the Red Sox stuff all over the place, so I figured.
Die hard Red Sox, even if they stink.
Favorite Red Sox of all time?
Ted Williams.
Ah, Teddy Ballgame. Nice. Good choice.
Yeah, used to go watch Teddy over Fenway Park.
Yeah?
Sit out in the bleachers where the fans were. 50 cents. That's what it charges.
On the Monster? Or
no. Well, see, they didn't have the seats when I was there on the Monster. It was out in center field, out in the boondocks, out there in center field where the real fans were. And then they eventually put the seats up over the Green Monster.
Okay.
I sat up there 3 or 4 years ago. Me and my one son went back, and he's a member of the Red Sox Nation.
Oh, nice.
And so he got tickets, and we sat up there.
Very cool.
$275 to sit up there. And I said, well, I'm glad you're buying and not me. But anyway.
What was your family like growing up?
Oh, geez, I'm the youngest out of 12.
Okay.
Actually, I had a brother die at birth and a sister after me. I'm the youngest out of 10.
Okay.
I'm the only survivor and the last of the Mohegans.
Attaboy. Well.
Yeah, I had I guess it was interesting. Did a lot of things back then, end of the Depression, when things were tough. But I keep telling my grandkids and my great-grandkids, you ain't seen nothing yet, the way the world's going.
Well, and just for everybody listening, how old are you?
I'll be 92 in August.
92 years young. Attaboy. Anyway, back to you were telling your grandkids and your great-grandkids.
I told them. My kids used to ask me, how come we never didn't go back to Boston to live?
Yeah.
I told them I didn't want them around the environment. I mean, back then it was different. It's an even a lot different now. But I don't know whether Ogden's catching up to them or not.
Probably in some ways, honestly.
Yeah.
Probably in some ways.
Anyway.
So what did your parents do for work in Boston?
My dad worked for the Charleston Naval Yard. He worked as a planner and estimator for the ships that came in. In fact, on the USS Hornet, the aircraft carrier, when it got torpedoed, Boston was the only place that had the big enough dry docks to bring it in to fix it. And my dad would go down with the ships and figure out how much it would take to repair it, how much steel, how many rivets, how much this and that and the other thing. And he told them, you know, and planned it, and they did a time limit and all that stuff. He was called a planner and estimator. And he worked for them for 44 years. But the day the Hornet was in, he took me over to the Charleston Navy Yard and went on the Hornet.
Oh, that's cool.
And I thought it was cool. Yeah, and it was pretty good. And all the sailors, you know, treating me ice cream. I even got to ride the lift where they bring the airplanes up and the airplane down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they did that. I thought that was pretty cool.
That is cool. Did
my mom never worked? Well, she worked before she got married, but she had a hard time raising 10 kids.
Yeah, that's more than a full-time job.
Yeah.
So what was living in Boston like at that time? Anything that stands out from your childhood?
You know, I guess I got along good with most kids. In fact, where I went up until the third grade, I lived in one house and all my friends and, you know, kids I run around with. But I moved across the street and put me in a different school district. And that then you didn't say I didn't want to go. You went to the school that you lived in. But anyway, it ended up that I knew more kids when I got up into high school because I was there.
Both sides of the street.
Both sides of the street, so to speak, yeah.
Okay.
And, I mean, you know, we did, I guess, just like everybody else. I mean, things were tough, and we didn't have a lot of things. My mom and dad never owned a house.
Okay.
Never owned a car. And I was talking to a bunch of the kids here in the ward here a couple of years ago, and they asked me, they said, what did you do for a date? And I said, you either walked or we took the trolley car or the bus or someplace. You know, and I said, really? I said, how did you make out? You know?
Very carefully.
You can always find out where to do that. But anyway, yeah. But it was good. I had a good childhood. I mean, it was tough.
Right.
I mean, things were tough. One thing about it, my dad always had a job, even during the Depression. And raising a bunch of kids and that. But, you know, and we got along pretty well as a family.
Okay.
My dad always used to say, at least, you know, I keep a roof over your head and clothes on your back and food in your belly, you know.
That's all you can ask for.
But, you know, but a lot of things I did maybe I shouldn't have done. But anyway, I do. I think I had a pretty good life. I mean, I got along real good. We had a lot of friends and so on. And come to think of it, I think out of all the guys that I run around, there was only two of us that actually went into service.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, one kid went in the Navy and I joined the Air Force.
What made you want to join the service was maybe that trip aboard the Hornet?
Well, yeah. Well, everybody kept on thinking that, you know, everybody from Boston goes joins the Navy because you're right by the ocean. But I had no desire to go to the Navy. In fact, well, I went over into Boston, and I thought because their allotment would be higher that there'd be, you know. And the guy turned around and went on to the Air Force, and he says, we're all filled up.
Oh,
and I
really?
Said, oh, okay. So but the next day I was over walking in the town next to me with somebody and went by the Air Force recruiting office, went in there and talked to the guy, and the guy said, when do you want to leave? Tomorrow? And I said, no, not tomorrow. anyway.
How did your parents take the news that you joined the Air Force?
I think it surprised the heck out of my mom.
Yeah.
My dad said, oh, well, if that's what you want. My mom, I guess, didn't want me because two of my brothers and my one sister, two of them got drafted. My two brothers got drafted in the Second World War.
Ah, okay.
And in fact, my one brother was in the Battle of the Bulge with Patton when they threw all the Germans at him toward the end of the war. My sister was in the Marine Corps.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She went to, she took her boot camp in Eugene, and then she went and spent most of her time over here in California.
Okay.
At the naval base. And I remember right after that, they were starting to let women go overseas. And so she wrote home and asked my dad, and she said, you know, is it okay if I go overseas? And my dad said, heck no, stay where you're at. I don't want you over there with, you know. So anyway, she did 3 years in the Marine Corps.
That's especially for the time. That's impressive. Quick question, just out of curiosity. What was your brother's name who was at the Bulge?
John, named after my dad, John Joseph Clemens.
Perfect. And then your sister that was in the Marines?
Teresa.
Teresa
Ann.
What was your job in the Air Force? What was your, like, assignment?
I was a liaison. I ended up over in France for 2 years. I was a liaison. I was the only Air Force guy stationed at an army port. I was a liaison. And all the ships come in with all the supplies for all of Europe. They used to code them, and I would tell them where to send them, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, ship them out and all that business. And then I was in one place. I was in Châteauroux, France, and then I went up to La Rochelle with a couple of guys, and then they sent me up to Saint-Nazaire, up the northern part of France. Pretty. 9 miles of white sand beach.
Oh, wow.
And on a clear day, you could look across the English Channel and see the white cliffs of Dover. Oh, man, it was pretty.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really
cool. And then,
cool.
Like I say, I was the only Air Force guy there. I mean, I had a whipped. I mean, I didn't do nothing except, I mean, you know, make sure that all the stuff was in there. And, you know, met a lot of new guys and so on and so forth.
I guess my question would be, what was it like being in the Air Force during the Cold War? Were you worried about that too much, or were you just too busy to be worried
about
that?
Not really. They had some, when I was over in France, they had some kind of an allocation or something. I don't know whether it was over oil or what, down in Saudi Arabia or down in there. And they thought they were going to have to send some troops down there in the Air Force. But then that went over. But that was the closest.
Okay.
The only thing is, that, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say it. I mean, but when I was stationed in Châteauroux, when I came back here to Utah, they had just put a new general in out at Hill Field as the base commander, Roby, General Roby.
Okay.
He was the general over there in Châteauroux. And they started to have race riots over there.
Okay.
The Frenchmen were encouraging the blacks to start, you know, harassing the whites and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And because they, France didn't really want us there. They wanted the Americans out of France as far as, you know, where I was stationed. At least that was the consensus of there.
Interesting.
But we used to have to, we couldn't go into town. If you went to town, you had to be back on base by 10 o'clock. 11 o'clock on Friday night, they let you stay an extra hour.
Because they anticipated problems with the locals?
Yeah, yeah. They, you know, some of them treated you nice and all that good stuff. But there was others that, but, you know, I got along. I had, like I say, in the office, it was just me and we hired a French kid. He could speak better English than I could. And he took all my paperwork. He did all the office work for me.
Oh, nice.
And calling the reports and so on and so forth. And he always used to keep asking me, when you get out, why don't you take me home with you? He wanted out of France. Anyway.
What is your wife from Ogden then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. She lived. She went to Weber High.
How'd you meet her?
At the USO.
Oh.
Down, it used to be down to 24th and Wall Avenue, in between 24th and 25th. I don't know, I can't remember what the hall was, but anyway, that's where you went in and danced and all that stuff. That's where I met her.
Okay. What's her name? Your
May.
Wife? May?
May, M-A-E. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. Passed away 9 years in June.
My condolences.
Yeah. Yeah, I got out of the Air Force and my wife and I were going to split the distance between Ogden and Boston, and we know who won that deal.
So that's what brought you to Ogden, was the Air
right,
Force?
I was stationed out of Hill Field.
Oh, okay.
And I met my wife out there. Then I went overseas, and then I come back and got married and went back overseas.
When would this have been? What years?
It was 52 to 56.
52 to 56.
1952 to 90, because I got out in 56, and I came out here in March, and I was on the police department on April.
Okay. So she won the argument about whether to go to
Boston. Where were we going
to
live, yeah.
Yeah. So what made you decide to get into law enforcement?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. When I got out, believe it or not, they say, you know, these people that got in the Vietnam War and how tough it was and how people treated them and so on and so forth. When I come out, I couldn't find a job. Yeah, they had a tough time. They did offer me a job. I went out to Hill Field. They told me I'd have to move to Denver, the only opening they had. And I come home and I talk to my wife. And she said, I don't want to go to Denver.
Oh.
So I stayed and I put applications, you know, all over. And when they called me and they said, you still want the job? And I said, yep, you bet. And a lot of my friends back there said, you a cop?
So what brought you to the Ogden Police Department?
Like I said, they were applying for them.
Uh-huh.
And so I applied and...
Did you know anybody or anything, or just kind of a random application?
No, I had to have my father-in-law talk to his brother. He used to be a high hockey or something, so to speak, and he knew what's going on, and he turned around, and I guess he went and put a plug in for me anyway.
That's helpful.
You know, politics, I guess.
Right.
But, yeah, when I went on, there was 10 of us.
Hired at the same time?
All at the same time.
Do you remember any of who they were? Or just some of them?
Well, Bob Warren, who ended up as the chief of police. Eliza Rivera, he left OPD and he went to the sheriff's department. And Roger Grant, he used to live up the street from me. And Mark Allen and Frank Loudenslager, Phil Camole, Dorsey Rocks, and Jim Anderson.
Okay.
He retired from the PD part of it. But they all basically left, except old Frank Loudenslager. He died of lung cancer.
Okay.
When he was on the PD. But Jim Anderson, I think he retired. And then Bob stayed. I think, but you have to tell Bob, and I don't know whether it's in effect now. Do you know Larry Thomas?
The name sounds familiar.
He was on when we were on, and Bob Warren... He used to live just up here. And I used to go shoot the breeze with him, you know, about the old time.
Yeah.
But he told me that he was the oldest retired police officer still alive. And he thought I was second, but he said Larry Thomas, he was older than me, but he didn't do as much time as I did.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, what Bob is deceased now, and I don't know whether Larry Thomas is still alive or not. If not, I'm the oldest retired cop from OPD.
There we go. So hired on in 1956. Did you have a training officer back then when you first hired on?
No. It was all with school of hard knocks.
Just here you go.
We met, if I remember right, we met a couple of days with the detectives, and they told us about what the detectives were supposed to do and all that stuff. And then we drove around with the, used to have the radio patrol. That's what Tim Dyer was, one of them, Lou Birch, Frank Dominic, and I can't remember what the guy's last name was, Wright. I can't remember what his first name was. But as they put us on like a roster, and we traded to go with different ones each night.
Okay.
And they, like I said, I think they worked from 4 to 2 or 4 to 6 to 2. I don't know, when it used to be an 8-hour shift before they went to the 4-10s.
So were you foot patrol or radio?
Oh, yeah.
Where was your first foot patrol?
I think they used to put two guys down on 25th Street.
Okay.
On Friday and Saturday night.
Okay.
That's when all the people that drank, I guess, and then a lot of the cowboys used to come into town.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. During the rodeo day, that was something else. Sometimes they put four of us down the street and walk the street, you know.
Yeah.
And the cowboys like to, you know, try and hustle all the Ogden women and get drunk and all that stuff. And then naturally, you know, they're feeling their oats. And then the next thing you know, they wanted to whip a cop or something, you know. But, you know, it was different. And then they used to have the, right behind 25th Street, where they used to have Electric Alley.
What was Electric Alley like when you first hired on?
Hoovers were.
Yeah.
They had sheds. You know, and you want to go, you go there. I guess if you got a high-class one, she had a hotel room that she would take you to. But it was different.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest thing was that, and then we had a lot of bootlegging.
Oh, really? In the 50s? Okay.
Yeah. The club, the one guy down there that cleaned up afterwards, he used to tell us every time he'd get busted, the bail was $300. The first $300 he'd set aside and knew that he was going to get busted every once in a while. He was a nice old guy, but I mean, he just
took the bust and went back to it.
Yeah. He had to knock on the back door, and he used to turn around and say, "Well, how come some of you cops come by and want my, you know, have a pint or a pint of milk?" And I don't want to hear that. we don't want to hear about that.
Right. So you had the cowboys that had come in and cause a ruckus on 25th Street.
Yeah.
Particularly.
But then we had I think that was called Beat 1, I think. And then Beat 2 was south of 26th Street from like Wall up to Adams. And you checked the businesses and so on and just walked around. And then if they wanted you, they have the light on top of the Canaan County building. The red light, if it was, I can't remember which was which. If it was blinking, it said to come in. If it was solid, you called.
Okay.
No walkie-talkies. You had to go to a phone booth and make sure you always carried a nickel with you when the phone call. You'd put the nickel in, and the operator would come in and say the police department.
Okay.
And you'd get your nickel back.
Okay.
And then they'd call the dispatch and say, we're looking for somebody, or come on in, or the sergeant's looking for you. Where are you at? You know.
And that's how they dispatched out calls.
You know, and this type of thing. And give you an update who was, what was going on, if something was looking for somebody in case you seen something. But there was a lot of times if you arrest anybody while you're walking, you had to find a phone booth to call for a car to come pick them up.
Oh, really?
Or else you walked them into the station if you were close enough and take them up to the ninth floor, you know, in the city and county building where the jail was.
So when you talk about Tim Dyer, who we covered in last season, episode 10, when you talk about him having a radio car, so those were the guys that were just in the car all night to drive around to pick up your arrests and stuff like that?
Yeah, whatever the area was,
Would they patrol too?
Well, they would, you know, they would be checking businesses or giving citations or whatever.
Okay.
And then we would, you know, take turns driving with everyone. I have to laugh. Old Lou Birch. Did you know Lou Birch?
I've heard that name many, many times.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Really a nice, good cop and all that. But he had used to tell us, he thought they were funny stories. There was no end to it. You know what I mean? You're waiting for the punchline.
Yeah.
And it never came. It never came. But he was a nice guy.
And he just kept talking.
Yeah. But I remember one time with old Tim Dyer, we had a guy that every time he'd get drunk, he'd fight. And it'd take about two or three to take him in. Big guy. And we were booking him at the desk there that the, you know, the jail, the police station used to be downstairs, and the second floor was the chief's office and the detective's office. And then they had two tanks, bullets, one for the drunks and one for the others, you know. And a lot of times if somebody would be fighting or whatever, and he thought he was really tough, and we had somebody else that was tougher, and it would throw him in with him.
Oh, was the, oh, in the other
in
cell?
In the other cell.
Okay.
I'm going to work him over. That's right. I shouldn't say that. But anyway. But anyway, we were booking this one guy, and he turned around, and he did. I think he took it, and Tim cold-cocked him, and like kind of blindsided him, kind of. And he says, who hit me? And Tim points to me, and he says, he did it. I says, I didn't do that. Don't put the blame on me.
Right.
And the guy says, I know. I'll get even with you, Tim. Because a lot of times, every time there's a pretty good-sized fight on 25th Street or whatever, it sent Tim Dyer and Lou Birch to take care of the fights.
Tim's a big guy.
Yeah. And Lou Birch was no slouch.
Yeah.
Quiet guy, but you really didn't want to mess with him. But anyway.
So they were like a two-man riot squad.
Right,
then.
Yeah. You know, they'd be in different cars, and they'd say, where are you at? And then all show up together. And they got to the point where a lot of times people would turn around and say, oh, here's Tim and Lou. Something must be going on. But it was good. One thing about 99% or more, I mean, the cops backed one another. If you weren't busy and they gave you a call that was maybe a little, it kind of used to have to ask permission. Can I go to one area to the other? We used to sneak over and just go in case he needed help.
Yeah.
And it was good. And we had a lot of good guys.
It seems like a lot. I mean, I keep saying the same thing. I think you had to be tough to work Ogden.
Well, yeah.
And I mean, I think to a certain extent, that's still true today. But especially back then, you had to be tough to get along.
You know, like I said, we had, I don't know, maybe they thought I was one, you know, sit back or whatever and this and that and the other thing. But you knew mainly if they send you on a call of, you know, fighting or whatever, you knew that when they sent the guy back, you knew you were going to have backing. He wasn't going to take all night to get there.
Yeah.
Damn, he was there. Then they'd either get out and just stand there, you know, but it was your case. You handle it. And then if anything happened, then he'd step in and help you out. But it was good. I really enjoyed being a cop. Yeah. I really did. I didn't get very far, but I mean, I still like that.
Hey, you know what? There's going to be people listening to this show, just hardworking patrol dogs that are going to be that's pretty cool.
And then after the patrol division, I went to, where did I go to next? I think I went to the detectives for a while. And then they put me in the youth bureau. I worked traffic for a while.
Who was the sergeant of the youth bureau when you were there? Do you remember?
Wally Fella.
And who was over detectives when you were in detectives?
I don't know whether it was Bob Carver at the time before they started the crime lab thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm almost sure it was Bob Carver. In fact, when he went to and took over the lab and all that stuff, the blood tests and breathalyzers and all that, he asked me to go, but I...
not feeling it.
It wasn't my bag.
Yeah, no.
But I didn't like traffic at all.
No?
I hated the thoughts of giving somebody a ticket. I even went to the traffic school, to Cedar City, to the college, and they had this guy that some university back east had taught, you know, the traffic and all that math that goes with it, you know, the point of impact and all this and that and the other thing. And I come back from that, and the first night back, the traffic guys used to go home at 2 o'clock in the morning. And about 2:10, they had a fatality at 26th and Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I was out on the north end. And they said, we got a fatality at 26th. And I think it was Wally Fella. Wally Fella turned around and says, Sid Clemens, he just got back from traffic school. He knows all about it. And I went out there and investigated it.
Just threw you right under the bus.
Yeah. And the bad part about it was, and we went to court, the gal who was driving and actually hit, she was an Indian gal. Minnie Hoochu, I never forgot her name. Minnie Hoochu got killed at 26th and Washington. But when they turned around and it happened, they switched.
Oh, seats.
Drivers.
Okay.
And so when they went to court and I testified and had all the diagrams and all that stuff, you know, being a expert from traffic school and all this stuff. And the defense attorney asked me one question. He says, did you see her driving? And I said, no, but the witnesses. And he says, Your Honor, he says, I think the case ought to be dismissed. And I'm looking at him and I'm going, you got to be crazy. Because the guy that we subpoenaed that seen them switch, all of a sudden he couldn't be found. Look. You know, I often wonder what happened.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
And the attorney got up and says, the defense attorney turned around and said, Your Honor, I make a motion the case be dismissed. And he dismissed it. And I looked at the judge and I said, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
And he says, do you know where you're at, Mr. Clemens? He says, you're in my courtroom. So he says, you be careful what you say. And I thought, holy crap. That bothered me a while.
I'm sure, especially with it being a fatal.
Yeah. Like I say, I used to get chewed out from the traffic. If I didn't investigate an accident, I wouldn't give you a ticket. Gal coming down 20th Street, going to work, slick. I mean, you talk about, you know, like icy. And so she tries to stop for the stop sign, I mean the red light, and she can't, so it swerves. And there used to be a market, and the guy had a cement post to prevent people from running into the house. Well, she runs into that. So I called, she had to have a wrecker. I called the wrecker, and the wrecker driver turned around, took her to work, and I didn't give her a ticket. I come to work the next night, and it's in my box. Big red line across the traffic report, and says, how come you didn't give her a citation? So I had to come to court the next morning. So I come in. I come home, change clothes, and I went back down for court, and I get the report, and that traffic sitting in. And, you want to give her a ticket? You give it to her. I said, I didn't think it was necessary. I said, what could she do? She couldn't stop the car.
Right.
I said, she slid into the post. She didn't hit anybody or anything. And he said, well, I want you to give her a ticket. I said, you write it. I said, I'm sorry, Sergeant. I'm not writing her a ticket. Well, I took a lot of flack over that.
Well, good on you for standing on your principles.
I mean, I used to try and put myself sometimes in your shoes. I keep thinking when I used to do that, coming down 7th Street, right by Gramercy, you know, where just as you start on the crest of the hill, the canal that's over there. Well, then we had a snowstorm like we had there, and I was assigned out in this area, you know, patrolling and that. And so I go down 7th Street, and I'm going down 7th Street, and then all of a sudden the car starts and it's heading for the canal. I had the door open, and I'm bailing out of this sucker.
Yeah.
And then it hit the curb, and I went for the rest of the way down 7th Street, and then, but I thought, what could I have done? I kind of liked working in the youth bureau for a while. Then they kind of hit. There was Wally Fella, Tim Dyer, Grant, but he was the other one. I'm trying to think of the captain that was over, the German guy. And anyway, worked with him. Worked with old Ernie Shaw. He was the lieutenant over the uniform division. Then he made captain, and they put him in chief for a while.
So of all the specialties, would you say Youth Services Bureau was your favorite specialty assignment?
I used to like patrol. Sure. And then I ended up in Central Services.
Okay.
I used to take care of the evidence room.
Okay.
And Harold Gibbs was the captain over the Central Services. And more or less I would supervise and make the shift changes for the, you know, the dispatchers and when they were in. Right there, when they went to the shift sergeant time, the desk sergeant to the women, and they started doing it, you know, and all that. In fact, I like volunteering for midnight.
That was your favorite shift?
I like night shift. More of them going on, and then they got to the point where they put the shift change up on the board, and they started going by seniority, that you could pick your shift and what days off you want, and when they went to the 410. And I had been, I think I was in the youth bureau, and I went back to patrol. And so I went in, I looked at the roster, and there was a guy that had Saturday, Sunday, and Monday off. And so I scratched his name out, and I put my name in. And he came in, and he said, how come you scratched me? I said, because I'm having Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off, or whatever it was. And he says, well, why don't you pick one of the other days? How long you been here? Well, no. But anyway, he took the next shift over. But then I used to do it. And then Jake was the chief. And he went to Bob Warren. He was the captain over the patrol division. And Bob come up to me and he says, the chief wants to know how come you're volunteering for nights. I said, that's where I like to work. I said, He said, well, he thinks maybe you ought to have a change. So I said, well, okay, fine. So the next roster come up, days on. So I went to days, you know, 8 to 4 or whatever it was. And I wrote my name in there for the good days off, you know.
Yeah.
I hadn't worked 2 weeks. And Jake called Bob in and says, how come Clemens is on days? He says, you just told me that he was on the nights too long. Now he's on days. After that one, I went back on nights.
They put you back on nights.
Yeah.
Good. Well, if that's where you want to
be.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked it. It worked into my schedule with my family. I hated swing shift. And they used to have a shift where you would substitute. You'd go 2 nights, 2 afternoons, and 1 day.
That's a tough switch.
You know, you'd get off. Like, say if I got off at 6:30 Monday morning, I'd have to come back that afternoon at 2:30 and then work Tuesday, Wednesday. And then Wednesday, when I got off at 10:30 at night, I'd have to come back at 6:30 in the morning again, you know. And then, but it was sometimes nice that you'd have a long 2 days off. It almost looked like 3 days off.
Right.
But I, now.
That'd be brutal, especially the older you get,
yeah.
You know.
And I'm going, I don't want that shift, you know. And a lot of times before they change, they put you on the shift.
Yeah.
You didn't request the shift. You put you on the shift.
Which chief was Jake?
Jacobson.
Jacobson.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what chiefs did you serve under?
Well, when I got hired, Maurice Schoaf. He was the chief. Golden Jensen. He came up from California. I think he was the chief deputy for the sheriff department just below Los Angeles. Ray Sanders, Ernie Shaw, Leroy Jacobson, Joe Ritchie. Yeah, I wasn't there. Mike Empey, I wasn't there. I ended up with Joe.
Okay.
I went from Schoaf to Joe.
Okay. Do you have a favorite? Is there any chief that you thought of as like your favorite chief you served under?
I like Schoaf right off the bat. When I went on the police department, he interviewed me. I mean, he was on the interview board, and he asked me, he says, you're from Boston? I said, yeah. And he says, do you get any fights back in Boston? I said, oh, I had a few. And he says, did you win them all? And I said, no, I don't think so.
You've lived here for...
I've lived here for 100 years, I think. It was the last house. The houses across the street were not here when I moved in. They were just finishing Hillcrest School. But these houses weren't here, and this was the last house in this section. And I got it under the GI Bill. But I went to First Security when it was on the corner, 24th and Washington. And a gal came around and says, can I help you? And I said, yeah. I said, I want to apply for a loan to get a house. She said, okay, just a minute. She says, go ahead. That guy there will call you. So anyway, I'll sit there for a minute, and he would wave me over. And he says, can I help you? And I said, yeah. I said, I want to apply for a loan for a house. And he says, oh, well, that's nice. He says, where do you work? I said, Ogden City. He says, doing what? I said, I'm a police officer. He said, you'll never get a loan on the wages they pay you guys.
Oh, my goodness.
And I went, what?
Right?
I said, how do you know I don't have $1 million in the bank? And he said, you'll never get a loan. I don't know. That's wonderful. But a guy that used to live behind me here, he was in the real estate business. So he turned around, he called me, and he said, Jim, I understand you want to buy the house, up behind me. And I said, yeah. So anyway, he helped me, and here I am, 1957.
And you've been here ever since. Well, that's impressive.
The thing I didn't like about Golden Jensen, we used to turn around when you didn't take home your car, but we could come home and come to lunch. And then when I'd leave in the morning, I tell my wife, I'll be home about noon if I can, so I have something ready. And so you turn around and you say, I'm out it, and I'd give my phone number, and they knew where that was. And there were times I'd be eating, and they'd call me, and I'd go answer the call. But anyway, Ernie Shaw was over the uniform division. He calls me in, and he says, the chief wants to know, who else do you know that's going home for lunch?
Really?
I says, you're kidding me. I said, what's he asking me for? I said, why don't he ask you? I said, you go home for lunch. Does he know you go home for lunch? And he looked at me and he says, he didn't ask me. He's asking you. And he says, he wants a letter. So I went in, I typed up the letter, and I says, yes, I go home for lunch, and my wife has it ready. But there's been times that I've been called by the dispatcher and gone out and taken care of my call and so on and so forth. And then he turned around and then he says, who else do you know was going on? And I said, if I knew who was going home for lunch, I wouldn't tell you anyway. And I signed it. Well, I was on the list from there on out because of my comment.
Well, and God forbid, we let guys go home for lunch, especially when they can still answer calls and they're living in the city.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't do it when I was like on the swing shift, the night shift. I mean, because I wasn't going to go have my wife at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, cook me something to eat.
Right.
But anyway, that didn't set too well with me.
I understand that.
But maybe that's bad mouthing them, but that's the way I felt. But all the rest of them, treated me. I didn't. In fact, when old Jacobson died, he left and went down, I think, south in southern Utah or someplace where he died. And I called the newspaper, and I said, you're going to do an article on him? And they said he doesn't want anything.
Interesting.
That kind of surprised me.
That is surprising.
is Jake was my shift sergeant when I first went on. Went through them all.
From the Ogden Standard Examiner, Thursday, May 28, 1959. Officers trap, shoot down suspect after holdup of Grand Avenue Market. A man armed with a rifle and two pistols was shot down in Riverdale by Ogden police last night, less than 30 minutes after a bandit robbed Food Giant Market, 3333 Grant Avenue. The suspect, hospitalized with a fractured collarbone and neck wound this morning, identified himself as Eugene D. Edwards, 23, of Redlands, California. His condition is good. Alert Ogden officers in patrol cars cornered the suspect immediately south of the Riverdale Viaduct. He dropped his weapons and fell face downward as four officers fired and hit him. Sergeant A.W. Folger, shift sergeant, said he had on him or had dropped to the ground a 35 caliber Remington rifle, a powerful 44 Magnum revolver, and a two-shot 22 caliber Derringer. Sergeant Folger said he also had $385 in currency in one pocket. It was just before 8 p.m. when a gunman appeared at the check stand in the Food Giant and ordered the clerk, Mrs. Harry Winifred Tomlinson, Roy, open the till. He flashed a pistol. Mrs. Tomlinson said she started to sidle away from the cash register and the bandit swung the muzzle of the gun toward her. Don't yell or move or I'll let you have it, he warned. Finally, the bandit reached across the counter and pulled from the cash register all of the currency. He ran out the front door, got into a 1959 model car, and sped away. Mrs. Tomlinson and other clerks obtained a partial description of the vehicle. All six Ogden patrol cars prowling the city were alerted. South Ogden, Roy, Sunset, and Highway Patrol officers went into action. The search centered on the southwest part of Ogden. Three Ogden vehicles started weaving the web around the suspect. Officers Leslie Bolter and Wayne Russell first spotted the suspect's vehicle. He was trying to pull behind some gravel piles at the Gibbons and Reed gravel pit, said Officer Bolter, that is just south of the municipal airport on 33rd Street. He saw us about the same time and headed east on 33rd. Officers Bolter and Russell followed the suspect almost bumper to bumper across the old 33rd Street Weber River Bridge, across the OUR&D railroad tracks and onto Wall. We hit those railroad tracks doing 70, said Officer Bolter. Another car was closing in. As the suspect turned his car off 33rd, south onto Wall, officers Gordon Hunter and Harry Meixel, traveling in the same direction, closed in behind the vehicle. The suspect sped south on Wall Avenue, then turned southwest on Riverdale Road, headed for Roy. Still another Ogden prowl car was closing in on the suspect on Riverdale Road, coming from the opposite direction. Officers C.W. Smith and James Clemens were on the Riverdale Viaduct when they saw approaching first the suspect's car and right behind it two police cars. Officer Smith jumped the island on the viaduct and skidded his prowl car into position to block the highway. The suspect swerved his vehicle off Riverdale Road just before reaching the blocked viaduct and took an old dead-end road that travels beneath the bridge. He traveled perhaps another 500 yards when the truck driven by Oliver Albertson, Riverdale, approached from the opposite direction and blocked the road. Officer Bolter said the suspect stopped his car and leaped out. Over his arm, he was carrying a bandolier of rifle and pistol cartridges, the rifle and the heavy pistol. We yelled halt several times, said Officer Bolter. Four officers started shooting. I fired when he turned and I saw the rifle, Officer Bolter said. The man pitched forward on his face. Officers approached him with guns drawn, ordered him to stretch his arms out. I can't, I'm hurt, the wounded man said. Don't shoot again. Though he was carrying three weapons, Edwards this morning said, I wouldn't have used them. I was trying to get rid of the rifle when the bullets started whistling by me. The suspect had little to say this morning. The car he was driving had an Iowa license plate, but he wouldn't say where he got it. Yes, he said on being questioned, I have a wife, two girls, and one on the way. The slug apparently caught him as he was standing sideways to the officer who fired. It struck him low in the front neck and coursed along the collarbone. The slug was removed from the near end of his shoulder. Minutes after the suspect's car finally came to a halt, more than 20 police, sheriff, and highway patrol cars were on scene.
Well, that kind of leads me into some questions. We looked through a lot of things that you were involved in where your name came up in the newspaper back in the day. But one of the things that stood out was interesting is apparently you were involved in a pursuit that ended in Riverdale, where when the guy got out of the car, he had a rifle. I think he lived, but they ended up shooting him when he jumped out of the car. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I think he robbed a market down on Patterson and Lincoln.
Okay.
And he took off. And me and Bill Smith, we went over to Riverdale, and they were chasing him along Riverdale, and he took that road that where the swim slide used to be.
Yeah.
If that's the one I'm thinking about. And he pulled, so Bill jumped the curb, and I jumped down, and I wasn't the best shot in the world. I tried to shoot his tire, though. You laughed about it now. But right across, it was down like a bar pit, and I'm trying to, you know, and there's some guys unloading a box car on the other side, and they're ping, ping.
Uh-oh.
I was hitting the bar. Too much leverage.
Yeah. All right.
From the Ogden Standard Examiner, Friday, September 20th, 1968. Husband and estranged wife dead in murder-suicide. A 25-year-old rifle-wielding man shot to death his estranged wife, then ran into the family garage and took his own life in a double shooting this morning on Ogden's East Bench. Ogden police identified the shooting victims as Victor Trujillo Jr. of 2055 Custer and Donna Swallow Trujillo, 21, of 679 22nd. Both apparently died instantly from gunshot wounds in the head fired from a .270 caliber rifle. The murder-suicide took place shortly after 8 a.m. outside the residence at 2055 Custer Avenue, where the Trujillo man had been living with his parents, Mr. and Mrs. Victor Trujillo. Authorities said the gunman shot his estranged wife while sitting in the front seat of a late-model sports car that fled into the garage as a police unit converged on the scene. Police said the gunman abducted his victim about 8 a.m. from her parents' home at 679 22nd and forced her at gunpoint to accompany him where the shooting later occurred. A call for assistance reached police headquarters at 8:04 a.m. by the girl's mother, Mrs. Ethel Swallow. She told officers Mr. Trujillo entered the Swallow home, rifle in hand, and threatened to kill his wife. Mrs. Swallow ran from the house to notify police as the gunman forced his wife into the car and drove east on 22nd, reports said. Officer J.P. Clemens was dispatched to 2055 Custer, where he heard one shot from inside the Trujillo car just as he drove up to the house. The gunman then sprang from the car and leveled his rifle at the police officer, who was still seated in his patrol car about 40 yards away. Officer Clemens said he took cover as the gunman darted into the garage and locked himself inside. The uniformed officer called for assistance, and within moments, the garage was surrounded by 15 to 20 peace officers. Police tossed a tear gas canister through the garage window, then forced their way in and discovered the victim dead, sprawled on the floor and still clutching the high-velocity rifle. Authorities speculated the berserk gunman shot himself in the head before they could reach the garage. The victim was found lying on the pavement between two vehicles, the bolt-action rifle resting across his body. Mrs. Trujillo, dressed in a flowered robe and barefooted, was found slumped in the front seat of the car. Police recovered two spent rifle shells and one live round of ammunition found on the floor just inside the garage door. The bullet had apparently jammed in the rifle and was ejected. Authorities said the young couple had been separated about 3 months. The Trujillo man's parents were reportedly vacationing out of state. Sources said they were due home today.
But the one was when they followed the guy up, he had shot his wife. And I chased him up and went up on top of 20th Street to Taylor. And that's when it was dead end. And he went down into a garage. And I got out of the car. And just as I got out of the car, he leveled his rifle at me. And I went, oh. So I got out. I turned around. I went behind a block of the car. And I had the radio. And so they sent help. And just before they got there, I said, I think you guys can cancel. You better send a detective or somebody to shot himself.
Now, I want to break in here for just a minute, because the fact that Jim doesn't say much about this story is very telling to me. However, the last thing I want to be accused of is putting words in Jim's mouth, so let me just talk in generalities for a second. This is a pretty traumatic incident when you think about it. It's a murder-suicide, but on top of that, Jim has just been forced to face down the barrel of a rifle. I think as anyone can tell you who has had similar experiences, you are going to see that moment in your dreams and in your sleep for a long, long time. Furthermore, with incidents like these comes the second guessing of, could I have changed the outcome? Could I have done things differently? Should I have done things differently? and the sleepless nights that come from second-guessing yourself in a high-stress situation like this. So I think Jim said what he had to say about this particular incident. However, there's a human element that goes into this, and again, to me, it's telling that he spoke briefly on it, and then we moved on in the conversation. But there's little doubt to me, and again, I don't want to be accused of putting words in Jim's mouth, but there's little doubt to me that the lack of detail that was given on this story suggests that this incident was, justifiably so, probably a pretty traumatic incident for all parties involved, and particularly for the first responding officer, Jim Clemens.
I was doing patrol, and I went over where they used to have the where the Coliseum was, when you went off the viaduct, when you used to be able to go down off the side of the viaduct and check the stockyard, and they had a restaurant there. And it was always getting hit, burglarized. And so I went out, and as I come down the ramp, I shut my lights out because of the car parked out in front. And so I kind of slowly went by, and then I turned around and come back. And then just then the guys come out of the building and took off and went, you know, took off to the railroad yard. And I tried to come because at that time they had a, where you could get out was 20th Street was and 31st Street. And so I said, you know, get a car that can go to them places, you know, and this and that and the other thing. But anyway, they got away.
Yeah.
I got chewed out the next night in briefing for letting them get away.
Oh, really?
And I said, you know, what could I do? I said, they got out of the car. I said, I'll follow them, you know. What more of it? But anyway, the sheriff's department got a tip. Two nights later, they were going to kick in a place on Riverdale Road, a bar, and wait for it to close when they were supposed to stay in there. And anyway, the sheriff's department, you know, picked them up and busted them and all that. And the one guy come out and they said, you know, how they ask, you know, what else you've been involved in and all that. And they said, yeah, they said, it's a good thing that cop over there in West Ogden two nights ago didn't come over to see us. They had one guy sitting behind the car with a shotgun.
Really?
And he said, and they were just waiting for me to get closer.
They were trying to ambush you.
They were going to blow me away.
Did you go tell your sergeant who chewed you out that you didn't rush headlong into an ambush?
I up my back of my neck when I heard that.
Yeah.
Be a little bit more careful.
Yeah, no kidding.
But, you know, it was good. But one of the best ones, though, is we had a call. The guy down on West Patterson was shooting up the neighborhood from his house. And me and Dave Reed, he was a lieutenant on the ship. So he's riding around with me. And so we went down and took the car. I went to the car, and he's inside. And he's standing behind the screen, you know, and we're trying to talk him. Dave's on one side, and I'm on the other side, so he couldn't shoot us. And he stuck the rifle, punched it through the screen, and old Dave Reed grabbed it and pulled him and the thing and knocked him over there. And he said, what did you do that for? He said, I would have come out quietly.
After shooting up the neighborhood?
Yeah, but it's a good thing, Dave. You know, pull the gun away, the rifle away from him.
That's incredible. He just, he got enough to get a grip and yanked
him
both out.
I wasn't aiming at anybody. I was just trying to scare him to be quiet.
Was he drunk or just crazy?
I think he was nuts.
Just nuts?
A lot of fun. I mean, you know, you can sit back and think of it now, and some of them are funny and some of them weren't so funny at the time.
From the Ogden Standard Examiner, Friday, June 11th, 1971. Woman 25 kidnapped, assaulted, flees captor. An Ogden woman was kidnapped at knife point at about 11 p.m. Thursday, locked in a pickup camper, then taken to a remote area of the city and raped. She was able to flee her captor and run to a nearby house where she received help. Police who identified the woman only as a 25-year-old housewife said she was forced into the camper at about 11 p.m. upon leaving a laundromat at 745 24th Street. The woman told Patrolman James P. Clemens, the camper was parked near the Utah Power and Light Company relay station in the 1800 block of Canyon Road. Patrolman Clemens said the woman managed to get a hold of a hammer after she was raped and the man left the camper for a minute. When her assailant returned to the camper, she struck him on the head a couple of times, but she was forced back and told to get out of the camper. As she tried to do so, the man reportedly tried to place a rope around her neck. The woman, however, managed to get the rope off. She told Officer Clemens she then ran, not looking back for fear she would fall. She said the attacker kept her clothes and purse. She ran to the home of Clyde Schweitzer at 1615 Canyon Road. Mr. Schweitzer took her into his home and clothed her, notifying police when she had related what had happened. The woman described her assailant as blonde, about 5 feet 8 inches tall, and weighing 160 pounds. She said he was between 25 and 30 years old. Officer Clemens said the woman was taken to McKay Hospital, where she was treated for shock, rope burns on her neck, lacerations, and bruises.
The guy used to live up here on 125 South, and he sold his house, and he bought a house over on Canyon Road, almost across the street from where they're building them new apartments or whatever, up in that area. But anyway, he was on the south side of the road, and he heard somebody crying. And he woke up about 1, 2 in the morning, and so he went out, and there she was, naked. So he went in and got a blanket and covered her over. And so I answered the call and, took her into the hospital and all that good stuff and so on and so on. He had kidnapped her from the laundromat, I think at 24th or 25th, just below Monroe. And anyway, and I kept on thinking, it's got to be this one guy that, most of us knew. And so anyway, we turned around and worked. Got a couple of detectives and so on, and we nailed them. And as soon as he turned around and started talking, he had done it before.
Really?
He had done time before. Yeah.
You know what? I mean, that's just, for anybody listening, impressive street work. Knowing to look at that particular laundromat and someone who was close to there, and then knowing the streets well enough to know who a likely suspect is.
Right, yeah. I mean, he's the first name that popped into my head because I had had dealings with him, before. Kenny Brooks and I, when we caught that bank robber, that was kind of funny, really. The guy turned around and used to be the Finer Tap that was on the corner of 24th and Kiesel. And Kenny and I were looking around and following, trying to think of different things, where he'd go and so on and so forth. And so we went into the Finer Tap and went to the bartender and said, did anybody just come in here? And he says, yeah, we had some guy that was just buying drinks for everybody. He says, but he left. But he said he was going to come back. So Kenny and I just sit there. And sure enough, he came back. And so when we approached him, and he still had a lot of money. And I think he even still had the... when they used to...
Like the dye pack?
The dye pack. Uh-huh. And they didn't even want to watch that. We turned around and we took him outside and this and then, we give him the Miranda thing and all that. And he turned around and he said, how did you guys ever find me? He said, find you doing what? Why? What did you do? And he said, I'm sure because it was like, I don't know whether the bank or credit union used to be on the east side of Washington on 21st or 20th or something.
Okay. You
used to have to drive up to the drive-in. I can't even remember what the name was. And then so we roused the FBI about our reward.
Hey, you're like, hey, we
and,
saw this.
Bank robbers, they always had a reward. And he says, sorry, guys. He says, if you weren't police officers, we'd turn around and gladly give it to you. You don't get it, Pretty cool. And we took him into the station and interrogated him all that and got a statement from him. And he turned around and pled guilty and they sent him back to the federal pen in Kansas or something. He was thinking back there and he wanted to change his plea. So we turned around and they sent him back here to Salt Lake to the federal court down here. And when he got home, all he wanted to do was come back and visit so his relatives could bring it. Because when they subpoenaed me and Kenny to go out again, then they called us and said, forget about it. He changed his mind. He said, all he wanted was a visit back to Utah.
It's a cheap way to get a visit from relatives who don't live in Kansas.
But it was nice. I mean, you felt good when you turn around and, nail somebody.
Yeah, especially.
I mean, they really, did something.
Like a rapist or a bank robber.
Yeah.
So it was you and Kenny Brooks, right?
On the
bank robbery. Yeah. How long after the bank robbery did you guys catch him?
Well, it was in the afternoon. We turned around. We did it that day.
Oh, same day.
All in one day.
Hey.
He turned around. I don't know what it was the instinct or somebody turned around and said, well, I think we seen a guy walking down from there. And then so we followed it and checked different places. And we went in, and then said, yeah, this guy's buying beer for everybody. He said he has a whole bunch of money.
I tell you, that's, again, just old school street cop knowledge.
The old street knowledge.
Yeah.
You got to know what was going on and who was doing what.
Right.
And so on and so forth. As I used to go, when I first went on the PD, I would go in when I'd walk 25th Street. I'd go in and get some of the mugshots, and I'd keep them. And then if I walked the street, and then if I'd see some, I would try and identify, yeah, he's in this bar. He's in this bar. And then I'd know him. And I got to know him. And then I don't know whether it's still true. They never wanted to be known by the cop. You know, you're a stoolie. Answer the prowler call up on the eastern and western apartments that used to be on 27th Street, just above the Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I went up there on a prowler call, and he's this one guy and two of his cronies are outside talking. So I walked by, and I said, hi, Shane, how are you? And I walked by. The other two guys looked at him, and I said, you're on a first-name basis with a cop? They walked away from him. They thought he was a stoolie. I thought that was funny.
That's really good.
Yeah.
That's really good.
We don't want nothing to do with you anymore, man. But we used to have an out. It's terrible. You couldn't probably get away with it now. We'd stop somebody and I'd say, where do you live? And I'd say, over there. And I'd say, where's over there? And I'd say, let me see some ID. I don't have any ID. You don't have a draft registration? You didn't sign up for the draft? That's a federal offense. You're supposed to sign up for the draft, whether you ever drafted or not. You're supposed to have that draft card with a registration card. Maybe give you a... We used to be able to book them. Hold for the FBI. Now, I'd come home and get off shift, and the FBI agent, you know, they'd call them if they had somebody in there. How long you want us to hold them, Jim? They could hold them 3 days.
Uh-huh.
How long you want us to hold them? You know, and if they weren't too mouthy, you'd kick them loose.
Yeah.
I mean, do that now? Oh, jeez. You couldn't get away with it.
Well, different times, you know? Different
times.
We
used to use that. I don't know what anybody else did, but I used to use it. If you got too mouthy or, you know, this and that and the other thing, or I thought maybe in order for me to get anything out of you, I'm going to have to fight with you or whatever, you know, and I don't want to do that.
Right.
They don't do that now.
No. Well, I wanted to ask you about, so did you cross paths with Doc White when you were first hired on?
Oh, yeah. He was one of the ones that broke me in. I walked beach with
Doc White. Oh, yeah?
Doc White, really, from what I do, and when we'd walk 25th Street, we'd go in the porters and waiters. It used to be down on the court, you know, for the blacks. Annabelle Wheatley.
Yeah.
She was on the run of it.
Yeah.
They didn't have too much use for Doc White.
Oh, really?
Doc White, when he would walk, at that time we didn't wear, like, jackets. We wore, like, peacoats if you had one, a navy peacoat.
Uh-huh.
And Doc would always carry an extra gun in his peacoat so we wouldn't have to go through his reach for his holster.
Oh.
And every time he'd go in there, he'd keep his hand in his pocket.
Like on his extra gun in his peacoat, really?
They didn't particularly care too much about Doc. Some of them, a lot of them didn't like, they thought he was a turncoat, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he was working for the white folks or whatever, and he didn't care whether they were white or black. I mean, he knew a lot of the bums and everything else, and I'm sure he had a lot of contacts.
Right.
That was, him and Jimmy Eason. Jimmy was, he was a nice guy. I got along good. Old Doc White used to tell me he was going to join the church and become a Mormon bishop.
Doc said that?
Yeah. Huh. And I said, well, good luck to you, Doc, because I had just joined the church anyway. But I'm going to be a man. I said, well, that's good for you. I walked a beat with him.
What was he? Was he a pretty tough dude?
He was, kind of mild-mannered and that. I got along fine. In fact, my kid went to school with Jimmy Easton's kid. He lived over here in Ron Clair.
Okay.
And they knew him. We got along fine. It was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, really, we got along pretty good. I think we got along real good, no matter
irrespective of differences, you got along.
Yeah.
You got along.
And one thing about it, I mean, you know, when you if you got a call and it was, you know, kind of iffish or whatever could happen, you always got back, you know, no matter what. Sometimes they would dispatch them for a backup. Another time you'd get there and there'd be some guy up the street and, you know, if you need me, I'm here. And that happened to me a couple of three times where I got in a few predicaments and all of a sudden, boom, you know, a couple of guys show up. You know, everything all right, Jim? And then the guy would turn around and look at him, or two of them would look at me. And I'd say, yep, okay now. And they said the attitude would just die right down.
There was some guys I wanted to ask you about that you worked with, too. Not only Doc, but what was Tim Dyer like?
Tim?
Yeah.
Tim was good. He was a good hearted guy. Yeah, I got along fine. In fact, my wife got real friends with his wife.
Okay.
When she was alive, yeah.
Okay. Troy wants, he would really very much like to know what Jerry was like.
Jerry and I got along real good.
Yeah?
We really did. I liked Jerry a lot. Yeah. In fact, I think I broke him in. And then he went in, you know, and got into the narcotics and stuff like that. But, oh.
So did you train Jerry?
Broke him in. Helped break him in when he came on the department in uniform.
Okay.
You know. Yeah, I broke in a lot of guys.
Any interesting stories there with Jerry and breaking him in?
Not really. You know, nothing, you know, real spectacular.
But nothing,
I mean, he was always there, like I say, when you needed him.
Okay.
You know, he wasn't the biggest guy in the world, but he was there.
Yeah, willing to throw down.
You had his back. Or he had your back, rather.
Okay.
And I remember I'd never seen him get too upset when he lived over on Melody Drive, I think, up off of 7th Street here.
Uh-huh.
The guy coming up the hill, well, they had kids crossing the street. This guy hit a 4 or 5-year-old kid and killed her.
Oh, goodness.
And Jerry came down, I mean, I wasn't there, but they were saying they thought Jerry was going to kill that guy.
Oh, really?
He said, because they come zooming up the hill at that time.
Yeah.
And so there used to be one of the radar traps a lot for them.
Okay.
Now they have a crossing guard there. Every time I talk to him, I said, that, you know, blankety blank, blank. Man.
What?
Yeah, I got, really, I like Jerry. In fact, like I say, he went, and when he went in, he started going with the other two buddies. It was like three of a kind. They all got along real good together. That I can't remember what their names are, but they were fun. They were fun to watch. We used to tell them they were watching too much TV with the detective shows.
Oh, really?
But they were good. They were, you know, they were buddies, you know. I got along real good with Jerry. I broke Griner in.
Oh, really?
I remember we went on a call. A runaway. We finally found her. We got a tip. And so they called and we went up and we picked the girl up. She was living with her grandparents. So we take her back up to the grandparents. And the grandfather come up to me and he says, I don't know what to do with it. He says, you know, his son or daughter was having troubles or something. So she was living with them and all that good stuff. And she says, she doesn't listen to us. She won't do what we say and this and that and the other thing. So I turned around. And she started up the stairs, and I called her by name. I said, come on back here. So she come back down, and I said, if you don't start listening to your grandma and your grandpa, all they're going to have to do is call me, and you're going to go to detention. Is that where you want to go? I said, I don't want to hear a peep from you or from them. She looks at me and she says, oh, okay. I don't know whatever happened. So walking out to the car, and old John says, boy, you had a hell of a nerve telling you that. I said, it worked, didn't it? I hope.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, man, you don't talk to people like that. And I said, maybe you don't, but I don't know that. You know. But anyway.
Was Spence Phillips one of the guys that you broke into?
Yeah, and then Spence went to the traffic division. He loved the traffic division.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe a year or so ago, the guy over here in the corner is a mechanic. And I was walking over, and I see this guy and his gal. And I kind of like walked by him because I didn't recognize him. And he said, call me what they used to call me on the police department. They used to call me Clem.
Clem?
Clem.
Okay.
And he said, well, you're not going to say hi to me, Clem? And I said, he said, Spence Phillip. And I said, oh, for Pete's sake, holy cow. It was a, he was quite the guy.
Was there a decade in your time working in terms of 25th Street or Electric Alley or something like that that sticks out to you as more wild than the others? Or
oh, yeah. I mean, there was always something going on 25th Street. I mean, every night, you know, more so, like I say, on the weekend. But actually, when I got on, the Electric Alley was just about, well, as they used to say, they pull the plug on it. They start getting all the gals up on the street or out of there,
yeah,
and all that, because different business started to show up and they didn't want that, you know.
Was Mayor Perry, Harmon Perry, still
Harm
around?
Perry.
What was, give me some thoughts on him.
Oh, Harm Perry.
Give me some thoughts on him.
Oh, he never, I don't think he ever listened to anyone. He used to have that beer joint over here on Canyon Road.
Uh-huh.
He taught a lot of the cops, though. He tried to do a lot for the police.
Did he?
Only if it was good for him.
For business. Yeah.
I remember sitting, he used to get broke in all the time. And so I went to work one night and they say, okay, Jim, you got the, you got to go sit and relieve so-and-so. And I said, you guys,
and this was
when?
Harmon Perry's place?
Harmon Perry's place.
On Canyon?
Yeah. Right okay. there. Well, not right to Canyon, just before you get to the Canyon.
Okay.
And anyway, and I'm going, you got to be kidding me. And so I went up and they dropped me off and relieved the guy. And, you know, you don't have a walkie-talkie. You ever sit in a great big place like this from 10:30 at night, and they did come and relieve me, I think, about 2:30 and put another guy in there. All the squeaks and all the noise and all this that you're hearing, you're wondering, uh-oh, is that somebody breaking in? Do I go to the phone now to call them, or do I wait, you know? Do I shoot him or do I not shoot him?
Right.
You know? Yeah. Well, he was a hummer. But I guess supposedly they think that he's great. He stepped on a lot of toes. In fact, I think he turned around and we had put in for a raise and he said, they don't need any more money.
Oh, jeez.
You know.
Thanks, boss.
They're probably overpaid now. I mean, I don't know whether it's true or not, but they used to turn around and he made comments about, well, who knows, maybe half of the cops are on the take anyway.
Oh, really? He said that?
That didn't go over too well.
I can't imagine so.
But he was something else.
For the record, for the listeners, do you ever see anything like that? The cops being in on the take?
No. Well, on Christmas time, we used to get a shirt. I'm going to be boxed for everybody.
Uh-huh.
A white shirt. And if you run the early shift, you got your size. By the time you come on night, you may not get your size. But, you know, they would do that, or else, I don't know, some of the restaurants, you know, you get your coffee and donut free and or a meal. But old Nephi Golden Jensen stopped that. I turn around and he says, there'll be no more gratuities.
At all.
So he cut it off.
Huh.
But the one guy, we had one guy on the department. We used to go to the Utah Noodle when it was on Grand Avenue, and they moved up onto Washington Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
But old Leo, it's called Uncle Leo, he'd go in there for lunch, and, you know, and run the house or whatever. And sometimes I just take my wife there after a show or something. And if he was there, he'd tell the waitress, you know. But anyway, we had one guy that was in there one night with his family, his whole family. And so the gal come over and give him the bill, and I guess he wasn't quiet about it. He was real vocal, and he turned around and he says, I'm a cop. He says, we don't pay here.
Oh, geez.
And the waitress looked at him and said, what? So she went to Leo, and Leo turned around and says, okay, you know, he called the chief the next day, and he says, no more freebies. I think would frown on anybody, you know, taking money under the table.
Oh, absolutely.
That'd be something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true. You can them or whatever. I had one guy bribe me. He ran a red light at 24th, and they used to have that, I think it was Fisher's Auto Mechanic, and used to come off the street and go in like a driveway, and the door was in. You had to blow the horn to get into the thing. So I got my red light, and I pull him in. He pulls in there, and so they didn't open the door when they seen the. So I got out of the car, and I said, let me see your driver's license. He says, I don't have to do it. He says, I'm on private property. I says, yeah, but the red light wasn't on private property. Do your driver's license. So he turns around, he takes out his driver's license, reaches in, and takes out his driver's license, and he hands it to me. And this is driver's license and a $5 bill. $5. And I says, and I dropped it, and I said, what's this for? He said, if you give me a ticket, you know, and they used to get 3 moving violations, they'd take your license away for 6 months or whatever it was. He said, I'll lose my license. And I says, that's tough. You know, I says, if I was to take you in the station right now and book you for trying to bribe me, I said, they would laugh me to scorn for a lousy $5.
Right.
and he looks at me and he says, what do you want, more? And I says, no, I don't want any more. And so I just wrote him the ticket. And I honked my horn, and the guys, they opened the door, and they're all looking at me, and they're waving him over, and I'm going, you know, I'm going out, you know?
Yeah.
$5.
Yeah, come on.
I laughed. I said, man, that's pretty good. Whether there was some that was doing a little bit better than that, I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to get involved. Yeah. I didn't even want to know about it.
Right, really. Absolutely.
I chewed out a woman one time because I was coming in the back of the station when we used to be in the city county building, and you'd go through the garage door to go up on the jail elevator. And there was a woman out there, kid was 4 or 5 years old or something, and he's going, hi, Mr. Policeman, hi, Mr. Policeman. And turn around, and the mother says, you don't talk to cops, they're no good. And I walked over to him, and I said, what are you telling that for? I said, what's the kid going to grow up? I said, hating cops? I said, have you ever had to call the cops? I said, why don't you like us? I said, everybody loves a fireman. Fireman, save my child. But all you cops want to do is give me a ticket or throw me in jail. That isn't the way to teach him.
I was going to ask you, so, and you would have worked with Bill Stettler too, right?
I was mainly with Bill when we were in the uniform division.
Okay.
When he, I think he became a shift sergeant. And I think I, and then right about that time, I started going to other places. I didn't really, you know, Bill lived right up here. I mean, I knew him. I mean, he'd talk to him, you know, and if a while we'd go for coffee or a drink or, you know, whatever.
But see him around. Hey, how you doing?
I was all on duty, saying nothing.
I got you.
I had to laugh when he turned around when him and all the boys got together and went in the vice squad, you know. I used to laugh at the the evidence that put it in an envelope, but they would never put, say, what was in the brown envelope, but they never put the money on the envelope, you know, that they marked and, you know,
stuff
in case they go to court. Well, every once in a while, I'd say when I was in the evidence, I'd turn around and I'd get a thing from the judge to burn, take it over to the incinerator, you know. So I take all that dope, and I never opened it.
Right.
But I did one time, and there's money in there. And I'm going, geez, I wonder how much money I burned.
How much did I burn?
And old Bill turned around, and I called Bill. And then, in fact, we went into the chief's office, Joe Ritchie. And I said, I wonder how much money we burned.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, geez, he said, we better not say anything about that. He said, I thought you were doing it. I said, no, I didn't say it. I said, no sense opening every envelope if it just said, you know, marijuana or pills or whatever. But anyway, that was funny.
Who were your good friends at the police department, or who would you say your pals were, the guys you hung out with?
Bob Warren and I stayed pretty close.
Okay.
All the way up until he died here, what, 2 or 3 years ago. He was a year or so older than me.
Was he chief of police at one point? Yeah. Okay.
We got along, but a lot of the other guys, I got along fine, but I mean, the 10 of us got along real well.
Yeah.
Except we had one guy that he was always involved in everything. I won't say which one.
Okay.
But he turned around. I chased I don't know whether he robbed a store, and I chased him out here to West Ogden or out on West Haven going through a field. And I ripped my pants. A farmer had put barbed wire and icing in and tore my uniform and scratched my leg and all that. But I, you know, we caught the guy. He was laying down in the crap. And so I took him in, booked him and all that stuff. Turned him over to the detectives again. The next day, the guy comes to work in briefing. He wasn't even there. He was day off. And he come in and he said, boy, wasn't that something yesterday chasing that guy? He said, boy, am I glad we got him. And I looked at him and I said, where do you get this wee stuff? I said, you got a mouse in your pocket? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't even there.
You weren't there.
Oh, yeah, I was. He's telling everybody. But that's the way it was. I mean, he knew everything and was involved in everything but the big deal. Anyway, there was Bob and, I don't know, there's two or three, you know, that I got along pretty good with. But
any other moments from your career that we didn't cover or cases?
Ever since you called me, I've been trying to, I sit here all by myself. And I sit here and I think, yeah, I remember this, but I wonder why I did that. Come, I didn't do that. But well, the thing I turn around and sometimes I often wonder, where did I screw up that I never got promoted?
That's the question you ask yourself?
You know?
Did you ever go out for it or were you just happy?
No.
Oh, did you?
No. And I used to say, geez, you know, there's a lot of times when the shift sergeant was off and I'd, you know, take over or whatever. But it always seemed like when they put somebody else in charge, they used to put an order out saying that so-and-so is acting sergeant while so-and-so's on vacation. They never did that to me.
Oh, never was an acting sergeant. Interesting.
But anyway, I don't, you know, and I keep saying, well, maybe it was you. You know, maybe you screwed up and didn't notice it or whatever. Or maybe you said something you shouldn't have said.
Maybe it was from that old letter to Golden about you're not going to tell on anybody else going over for lunch.
I think a lot of who, and I'm not looking for any pity or excuse, but I used to say what I think, and a lot of times they didn't like what I thought.
So when you retired in 86, right?
Yeah.
Anything after that or just were retired since then?
I had a couple of jobs. People would call me like some conventions and that, and I'd just, you know, go down there and make a few bucks, security type thing in case somebody needs something. I had a couple of people call me, wanted to offer me jobs that went in like the private detective type things, you know. And I'd say, well, you know, how much and all this stuff.
Yeah.
They'd say, well, you had to go on shift work. And I said, shift work? I said, you're kidding me. I said, why would I do that? I left the job. I worked Monday to Friday, all holidays off, all the weekends off, all, you know.
Right.
Like, why would I come back and start all over again at the bottom worrying about, well, I'm going to be on swing shift this week, and next month I'll be here. And I said, I don't think so. And anyway, that's the way I felt about it.
Well, retired for almost 40 years. That's a dream in and of itself, just to be able to be retired and do what you want to do for that amount of time.
I did. Yeah. I have people around here in the neighborhood turn around and say, you retired when you were 53? I said, I was almost 54. And they say, 54? Man, I can't even think about that.
What's some stuff you like to do not working? Like, what personal interest-wise, besides being a Boston Red Sox fan and a baseball fan?
Oh, I like to go fishing.
Fishing?
I love to fish, yeah. Well, I like to fish. My wife and I used to travel quite a bit. I'd go around visiting the kids. And like I say, we went to Greece, went to Germany.
Favorite place you've ever visited?
I love Germany. It's clean. I mean, really, I was impressed.
Interesting.
I'm really, really impressed.
Are you? I see the Irish blessing on the wall. Are you Irish?
Aye.
Aye, me too.
Went to Ireland 3 years. That's where I went. Me and my son, he went on a mission over there. And him and his wife and his daughter and her husband went, and they asked me to go with them. And my dad always wanted to go back to Ireland.
Yeah.
But he, like I say, raising all the kids and whatever, and he never could afford it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, my dad would love to be here to see it, because that's where his mom and dad came from.
Oh, they came
from. In fact, my wife, when I took her back for the first time, she thought my mom and dad came from Ireland.
Oh, really?
They had a little bit of a tang, I guess, but I never noticed
that. That Boston East Coast.
And they had a little bit of a like the Irish thing, you know, the you know, the potato, vodka, but anyway, but it was good.
So one of my questions to you is going to be, in this day and age, law enforcers, cops, they're dying younger than the average, even after they retire. So you're 92 and you could pass for 72, I think. Like, I'm not just saying that greasing your wheels either. I mean, you're very spry. And so what's your secret? What would you recommend to the guys out there in terms of not having a heart attack the day after retirement?
Patience. Maybe try to put yourself in their shoes. You know, what are they thinking about? What would you have done if you were in that situation? You know, I mean, and try and feel what's going on. What are you trying to tell me? You know, why did you do that?
Empathy.
Right.
Empathy.
Lots of that, really. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and like I say, I still turn around. I try to be friendly to everybody. I enjoyed it. Like I say, I thank the good Lord. I mean, I never got really bunged up.
How much did you see Ogden change over the course of your career? Because we're talking the 50s to the 80s, so four different decades you were in.
You know, like I say, when I retired, I used to turn around. The respect for everybody. I mean, not just for the cops. I mean, home, school, wherever, you know, everybody, don't tell me what to do. What are you stopping me for? You know, if we stop somebody, they never gave us that. I mean, the news. I get tired of watching the news. Guy going and killed three kids and three adults? A kid? Why? I don't think I could be a cop now. No offense. It's a lot different. I don't know how you put up with some of the crap that you have to put up with. All they want to do is cut you off. You can't do this. You can't do that. Like I say, kicking all the druggies out. I mean, it makes everybody be a politician.
That's exactly what it does.
You better believe it.
Jim, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sit down with us and sharing a little bit of your history with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, really. But like I say, no, I don't think I could be one now.
Any last messages for the listeners out there?
I keep thinking about it. My grandkids will ask me once in a while, what was it like being a cop? That's a lot different. A lot different.
What a ride, right? My main takeaway from talking with Jim is Jim was 100% a hardworking beat cop. But not just a hardworking beat cop. I mean, he wasn't the type of guy to sit in a parking garage. Clearly, the man knew the streets. He knew the streets. He knew who the likely actors and suspects would be in any given crime. I mean, the rapist that he brought in by just knowing the streets is a perfect example. Similar with the bank robber case in the tap room. So he was not a passive participant in police work. He was a very active, proactive, and street knowledgeable street cop. And that's my takeaway from Jim, and I think that's the lesson there. He put down some cases, the cases that he did put down, with old school police work. And I want to point out the priorities at the time of law enforcement, which there's been a bit of a difference and a shift from Jim's era into our era. But for example, Jim was expected to know the streets and he was expected to be proactive. Now, he exceeded those expectations clearly from the stories that he told. But just as an example, in Jim's era, if a building was broken into in your area and you didn't find it, you would be at the very least in hot water, if not fired. And, you know, an example of that is in Jim's story when he pursues those suspects into the rail yard that ultimately were setting up to ambush him. If you notice the next day in briefing, it was a confrontational, why'd you end up losing those guys? Because the expectation on these hard working, proactive street cops of yesteryear was that they were going to be proactive and they were going to be the ones to catch the societal ills or the societal bad guys of that era. So that's my takeaway from Jim Clemens. He's someone Ogden should be proud of. He's someone I'm proud of. He is the hardworking beat cop for a career spanning over four decades that set the table of tough Ogden policing for the department that we
represent today, and that is represented by today's tough cops of Ogden. So, Jim, we salute you, and we hope this episode has done you the justice that you and your family so thoroughly deserve. Now, I want to take a break here to go into a note for our next series of episodes. Ladies and gentlemen, we are very excited to tell you that in accordance with the new Apple TV special, Masters of the Air, we are going to be bringing you a series on Ogden's Masters of the Air. Local Ogdenites connected to Ogden in the northern Utah area who fought in the air, in the European theater, and in the Pacific theater. So that's something up and coming that we are very excited to bring you. Now on a final note of Jim Clemens, as you may have noticed, we let the individuals that we feature, if we can, pick their outro songs, the songs that they feel like best encapsulate them and the message that they are trying to get across. And this song in the outro is a song requested by Jim Clemens, and we are more than happy to oblige him. And we will see you all on the next mini-series, Ogden's Masters of the Air.